Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Stein.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. Nothing like promoting yourself as intelligent, imaginative, and hospitable. I love it. Advertising, it's amazing. I have a great, great honor tonight to introduce the man that got me into broadcasting, truly. He was the general manager of KZOK to a rock station in Seattle, Washington. I had a near-death experience when I was 40 years old. He visited me in the hospital and said, I literally had tubes in my nose. I had, you know, I was on IV. I was going to be in bed for 2 months. I had destroyed my lungs in a bad case of pneumonia. And this man had the great wisdom to look at me. I was, he says, Dick, I've always thought you should be in broadcasting. Ladies and gentlemen, Bob Powers. Woohoo! Now, you know, there's amazing things that happen in your life, and you don't know when people walk into your life how they're going to affect the trajectory of your life. And I'm sure you've all had things like that happen where, you know, crazy people come into your life and change them. And Bob's one of those guys in my life. And being crazy myself, it's hard to recognize other crazy people when I see them. But, wow, it's great to have you here tonight, Bob. Bob lives in Yakima now. And are you still on television?
No.
Okay. Well, we'll find out what Bob's doing. Yeah, we got lots to talk about. Well, we're so glad that you're here tonight. And we're going to have a great show. We're talking about the theme, putting the fun in dysfunction, how Hollywood does family. And we've got a great panel tonight. Jenny Spohr is with us, of course, Presbyterian clergy, producer of The Kindling's Muse. Can we have a big round of applause for Jenny? And ladies and gentlemen, Jenny has just informed me that she's expecting again.
Yes.
So she continues the longest ever leave of absence from the producer of a show.
Exactly.
Just keeps popping out those babies. Dr. Chris Cheney is with us. She is associate professor. Are you associate or professor?
I just got promoted to full professor.
Yeah, I want to change that because I really, ladies and gentlemen, professor of English and chair of the English department at Seattle Pacific University. And a film buff and a literature buff and an all-around great person. Let's have a big round of applause for Chris. We have a very special treat tonight coming all the way. We've got two immigrants with us tonight. Illegal aliens are on the show. And one of them is our dear friend all the way from Scotland, who used to be on this show fairly regularly here until he had to leave the country for reasons we don't want to get into.
Yeah.
Nothing like the IMF scandal, I want to assure you that. But anyway, Bill Hogg is with us, ladies and gentlemen.
Yay! Welcome.
And then we have a newfound friend whose work I've been able to follow from afar. I'm glad to finally meet him. Kevin Miller, who wrote the film Expelled with Ben Stein. No intelligence allowed.
That's right.
All right. So, that's it. That's the whole show. I hope you've enjoyed the introductions. Jenny,
yeah.
This whole idea of dysfunctional families was your idea. Of course, I couldn't understand that because my family is not dysfunctional.
I know.
But you, being a mother,
yes, and
suddenly
coming from
decided this was a subject worth doing. Tell me about the idea behind this show.
Well, honestly, it actually came from wanting to do a show just based on one director's work. And we were kicking around the idea of doing Sam Mendes, who, of course, is famous for American Beauty and Revolutionary Road and Away We Go and some of these other family dysfunctional family movies. But then we wanted to expand it a little further than just his work and felt like there's a lot that comes out in Hollywood and in our culture that is begging to inform us on how we should be family and what family looks like. And the movies that we picked tonight are basically people trying to struggle to define family and whether it's going to work for them or not.
So why did we choose dysfunctional families?
There are very few functional families portrayed in movies. And partly because then there would be no drama. There'd be no tension. There'd be no crisis, right? There's got to be some sort of tension involved. So
now, Michael Medved, friend, wrote the book Hollywood versus America.
Yes.
And he said the dream factory has become the poison factory. Mm-hmm. And Michael would probably, if he were here tonight, argue that the way families are treated in Hollywood is actually perpetuating the problem, that families, you know, are not necessarily this dysfunctional, but Hollywood finds it entertaining, and they like to make entertainment out of sadness and sorrow. What do the rest of you think about that? I mean, is Hollywood capturing what's going on? Is it getting into the zeitgeist of families? Or is it, in fact, expressing what Hollywood understands about families, since they're in a bubble often in the worlds they live in? Or are they really kind of getting on what's already there? Or are they trying to send a message to people that is sheerly entertainment-oriented? Well, this would be funny to look at these dysfunctional families.
It's got to be a bit of both, because obviously Hollywood's a commercial enterprise, so if there's no
It is?
Yeah, surprise,
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, go figure. So if there's no resonance with what we see in the theaters, then people won't show up. But there's also, I mean, we were talking about this, Kevin and I, coming down the car, about The Kids Are All Right, mm-hmm. which is a radical redefinition of family where you barely tolerate the male species as sperm donors. And this apparently has been...
Say that again? Sperm?
Sperm.
Sperm. It's spelled S-P-E-R-R-M.
For a minute, I thought you said spam. Spam donors.
No, sperm.
We're talking about Hawaii's favorite meat.
No, that's a different film entirely. Okay, that's Blue Hawaii with Elvis Presley. But
okay.
No, the idea where Mark Ruffalo's character, you know, he's a marginal figure, and it speaks of the marginalization of the male species, and what's he good for? Pretty much nothing, apart from he can supply what neither of the lesbian can supply, who are the co-heads of the family, namely sperm. And this has been Julianne Moore's labor of love. Kevin was telling me for years. So clearly there's an agenda at work, whether she's working out her stuff. She had a gnarly romance that went sour and poisoned her against the male species in the past.
Oh, did I?
All right. Climb in here, Chris. Go for it, Chris.
No, I think that's really interesting because it's a good counterbalance to my sense of the six films that we're going to talk about in our discussion shortly are so male-dominated. They're all about the father and the father's lack of a partner and a wife. We don't tell the wife what's going on. Secret struggle over money or sexuality. And so it's all about the sort of lone wolf male in a world of women and children who don't understand it and who sort of nag and whine.
Really? I mean, because in Away We Go, we've got the male who wants covenanted long-term,
yes.
You know, basically wants traditional marriage, wants till death us do part. And he's compassionate and tender enough to understand why his girlfriend doesn't want that. And they have a kind of quasi-exchanging of the vows on the trampoline.
They sort of do DIY marriage. That's the one that's I think, a sort of interesting outlier with the millennial generation.
Yeah.
But the older films, the sort of Steve Martin character. In addition, the film Win-Win, which would be the other one that's contemporary in the theaters right now that I would really encourage people to look at. That Paul Giamatti father figure also is very much a lone wolf with a whiny, naggy wife. And so I think there's just sort of both narratives are happening. But I'm not disagreeing with the sperm donor sort of aspect of The Kids All Right.
That's very questionable.
Before we talk about dysfunctional families, would someone tell me what a functional family is?
Jenny, go ahead.
What is a functional family? Does anybody out here have one?
Kevin Miller does.
Yes.
Kevin.
Yes.
Okay, good, Kevin. What is a functional family?
Well, you know, I think it would be a family that doesn't manifest dysfunction.
Whoa! This is why we bring in the ringers from Canada.
You know, it seems almost like a political question to ask and you know, to try and respond with, here's an ideal structure or here's an ideal way of relating. I'm kind of hesitant to say that, but I would just say... you know, a family where every family member has a role, and again, I'm kind of qualifying my statement as well, but but they have a role that is defined for them, something that they that gives them identity. And I think that what we're seeing in a lot of these films is people struggling. We talk about the male that's got the whiny children and the misunderstanding wife. I think it's actually representing a loss of identity and a search for identity. And so I think a family ultimately is the primary socializing unit of the culture, which is helping you understand really who you are.
Yeah. But given what you've just said, would we all agree that these are in fact the issues that are going on sociologically in our society today? I mean, you know, not Time or Newsweek just ran the thing about the beached American white male. And what's happening to men in our country? I think it was something like that, but that could have been a dream that I had.
Okay. Reading Dr. Seuss late at night.
Yeah. My wife's got me reading before I go to sleep at night, and it's
bad.
Doing strange things to my dream life. But it was a story about what's happening to men in American culture and society and how this particular the economic impact on white men 40, 50 years old and older is devastating that whole population because women have been now in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things going on, and it goes very much to what Kevin was saying about identity and knowing what your role is and knowing who you are. Back in the 90s, when I first moved back here, I interviewed Susan Faludi, who had written a book about the Anita Hill hearings and Clarence Thomas, very critical of Clarence Thomas. But then she wrote a book that happened because she watched the Promise Keepers movement, and she decided Promise Keepers was a bad thing. And, you know, it's a bunch of male dominant Christians. And so she actually went to a Promise Keepers, and then she went to some small groups of men in Promise Keepers, and she's this radical feminist who says, wait a minute, these guys are basically trying to be good husbands and good fathers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What's wrong with that? You know, so, I mean, I think that kind of trying to define who we are in culture and, of course, the gender blurring issues and the... I think, in that sense, would we agree that Hollywood is talking about what's going on in our culture, or are they taking it farther than, you know, when you use the word agenda... Mm-hmm. Do you think they're promoting something, or are they actually just interacting with what's already there?
Well, I would contend that Julianne Moore, clearly if she's been working at getting this film on the screen for years and years, there's something driving that. But say, take a film like Away We Go, mm-hmm. there's a sense of resonance and poignancy that we can all identify with. Yeah. That there's a yearning for belonging, acceptance, community, and there's a recognition that we can't make it on our own. So partly our journey is to say, is there a wider community in which we can plug into? Where can we find the kind of family that we want to be? So it speaks to a yearning for intimacy, belonging, and acceptance, but also mentoring. Like, how can we get a compass, a relational compass, a sexual compass, an emotional compass, a spiritual compass to help us be a family, to help us relate to one another, so they go on this kind of bizarre road trip and end up in Montreal, where the girlfriend is yearning for the love and tenderness and affection that she sees amongst the kids and between parents and adopted kids. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you realize as they're at this nightclub together that they're broken as well, because we're all broken. Yeah. So I think it's not necessarily that there's filmmakers on a soapbox, but I think there's a resonance there, particularly in that film, out of the ones we've chosen, with what's common with being human. Mm-hmm.
Why are we entertained by dysfunctional families? Why do we watch movies about dysfunctional families and get some sort of entertainment value out of it?
I think entertainment, though, is really, if I look at films, that's one of the lowest values that films have to offer. I think that one of the problems as a society is we've reduced film to entertainment. It's the entertainment industry. I think that storytelling and filmmaking actually performs a really important function in society, which would be basically helping us. I would look at every story as really a moral argument about what's the best way to live, mm-hmm. and that's what's really being worked out in these films. And so entertainment, I think, conflict always, you know, is maybe entertaining to watch someone else's conflict, but I really think that what's driving our interest in these films goes much deeper than entertainment.
But what's interesting is if you look at the films that we're talking about tonight, Parent Trap was basically a Hollywood product. Mm-hmm. Ordinary People was a Hollywood product, but it's kind of an indie film. It feels like an indie film. Mm-hmm. Ice Storm is definitely feels like an indie film. Little Miss Sunshine's an indie film. Parenthood is a Hollywood film. Mm-hmm. And Away We Go is an indie film. So the independent filmmaker is definitely trying to track into stuff that matters.
How would you define, though, when you use the word Hollywood, that are you saying that films produced by corporations versus films produced by individuals?
Well, I think I'm saying it's an oversimplification, but the idea that afflicting the comfortable is what tends to happen in indie film, and comforting the afflicted tends to happen in Hollywood.
I see.
They want to make a film that's going to make you feel better when you get done with it. Whereas an indie film, and I go to this point on Julianne Moore, because if you go to Sundance Film Festival, which I go every year, 80% of the films there never make it to the big screen. Mm-hmm. And they're all made, almost all made by people that have a passion about the story.
Yeah.
It's an important story to them for some particular reason. And that actually tends to mean that it's based on reality. In my experience, not just agenda, but they've actually had a painful experience that is so deep that they want people to hear their pain or hear what it was that they've experienced. And so these indie films, in my view, tend to grow out of that kind of, I've got something to share that I want you to hear, and I'm willing to mortgage my house to make it happen, mm-hmm. you know, versus the corporate model, which is we got to figure out how many eyeballs are going to see this film, what the demo is going to be.
Product placement.
Are we going to make enough money on this thing to make it worth it? It's a different dynamic.
Yeah. Well, I think there's substance to the dualism you're framing, because if you take Parent Trap in both its iterations mm-hmm. with Hayley Mills, she's chirpy, she's cheeky. It really minimizes the pain. I mean, we talked about how the dream of every kid who's seen Mom and Dad relationship fractured is to be the glue that brings them together. Yeah. And so whether it's the Lindsay Lohan iteration or the Hayley Mills, there's really a minimization. It's a saccharine sweet treatment, whereas these other films...
Jenny, talk about the juxtaposition of Parent Trap on Ice Storm.
Ordinary People.
Or Ordinary People.
Okay. So we actually set up these films to sort of contrast, compare and contrast each other, and we're comparing and contrasting Parent Trap versus Ordinary People. In Parent Trap, a little background, my parents got divorced when I was around 7, maybe 6, and I saw the Hayley Mills version in elementary school of when this was occurring in my life, and I was probably one of the only kids that I knew of whose parents were getting divorced. This was not something that happened very regularly back then. By the time I got to college, I would say 80 to 90% of my friends' parents were divorced, so it wasn't... It became common as I got older. So seeing this movie, but I knew well enough that if I sang a cheeky song called Let's Get Together in a duet with my brother, my parents would not fall in love. I mean, it was just, I knew this was sort of a hopeless case, even at 7. But yes, seeing The Parent Trap, I mean, this is every divorced kid's wish dream, you know, that I will be, I am so many divorced kids of divorce feel that they are what has shattered their parents. And so they wish that they would be what brings the parent back together. So it's something that I did that drove you apart. It's something I can do that can bring you back together. And it is that complete fantasy, basically. It's a total complete fantasy. Versus Ordinary People, you've got... how many people have seen Ordinary People? Familiar with it. Okay, it's Robert Redford's first directorial film from 1980. It won the Academy Award, and it's about a family, an upper middle class family, whose eldest son has died in a boating accident, and the younger son has basically taken all of it upon himself. He believes it's his fault his brother has died. He believes it's his fault anything. I mean, that it's raining. He could, you know, and he's a more classic figure of a child who is in a dysfunctional family. Sort of, he's made himself the scapegoat in this family, and has taken it all upon himself, and his family slowly dissolves around him in it. And so that, you know, that's why those two are paired, because it's this fantasy that we get, you know, from the stereotypical Hollywood, let's get together and feel good after this movie, and then Ordinary People,
well,
where you're kind of left destroyed with a bit of hope.
Mary Tyler Moore did this film after the Mary Tyler Moore Show,
yes.
which was all this light and fluffy stuff.
Yes.
And suddenly you're seeing this cold, unloving, brittle, uncaring...
Who won't hug her son.
Woman who won't hug her son, who's tried to take his own life.
Tried to take his own,
And it's just, those performances were so tightly drawn. Yeah. It's an amazing film. What are some of the others of you want to observe about ordinary people when you look at it in relationship with Parent Trap?
Parent Trap was interesting. Do you know it was a German novel first? Mm-hmm. And so what's interesting to me is that it was sort of the Disney Factory version of this story that almost is fable-like about the twins that are separated, and you know you almost have a sort of Brothers Grimm shadow in the background, and then turned into that the chirpy divorce reconciliation. They really, truly still loved each other, and the proof is they never married anyone else, right? And all the servants that conspire to help versus a kind of story of, you know, that where you have the monstrous mother, and that's Ordinary People is one of my, you know, sort of the horrifying ice queen, the mother and wife who is, you know, she's almost evil in the point of totally rejecting love and wishing the Timothy Hutton character had died instead. She's monstrous, and so there's that. At least one of the ways that this gets thrown off is that monstrous woman.
Well, but she's monstrous, though, but I wonder if she does tap into, you know, people. I don't have two children yet, but I'm sure deep in my heart, one of them might be my favorite, you know? So there's that, you know, drilling into that a little bit.
Totally. More too. That's a sin, though.
As you say, we're also comparing with a Disney Factory.
Yes. Right.
As Mark Pinsky called it, faith, trust, and pixie dust.
Yeah.
And so the thing about Disney is it's like a feel-good... analgesic, where even Mrs. Doubtfire, the dream does not happen. You know, it sets you up that, yes, there's going to be reconciliation, but it doesn't happen. So so there's a realism in Mrs. Doubtfire, which is a fantasy flick, that Disney consciously skirts us away from because it's very calculated feel-good escapism.
Right.
I would say, you know, of the same vintage of, say, Ordinary People is... Nightmare on Elm Street or some of these 1980s horror movies which often showed kids dealing with the dysfunction of their parents. And you look at Freddy Krueger, it's really Freddy Krueger exists because of the parents' dysfunction. And so who's left to deal with it? The parents are so involved in that movie in particular, fighting with each other, these kids are left to deal with the monsters. If you look at all of the 1980s horror movies, essentially the message is, hey kids, we're on our own. And we're left to deal with this. We've been abandoned by our parents, who in a sense are in the midst of deconstructing the traditional family. And so I think almost there's another generation in the 1990s, and we can talk about it next.
Wow. Freddy Krueger has entered the family.
Wow.
Talking about dysfunction.
We should have Kevin on our zombie show.
That's right. We're going to be back with more of the Kindling's Muse coming up right after this. We got to talk about some other wonderfully dysfunctional families in Ice Storm, Little Miss Sunshine, Parenthood, and away we go. This is Dick Staub. Don't go away. Be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, this is Dick Staub back with you. I listen to Bill's show, and he says ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls all the time.
I also say lads and lassies.
Yeah, well, that's that. Are you wearing a kilt when you're doing this show?
I'm wearing a kilt, as every Scotsman should.
Yeah, okay.
That's right.
Do you remember when we did that demo?
Oh, yeah, that was...
We did this demo for a show that we were working on that never got made. And in the middle of it, he was a caller into the show, and he got in this thing about, I said, well, are you wearing a kilt? And he says, I'm wearing a kilt. I'm a Scot. And I said, well, what do you got on under your kilt? And he says, that's none of your business, Mr. Dick Staub. And it was quite hilarious.
It was.
At least it seemed like
it. It's a classic.
That's why that demo never was made into a show. Actually, it was so pathetic.
But if we uploaded that to the website, we'd get more hits than it.
That was like the high point of the show, as I recall. Well, so anyway, we're here tonight talking about dysfunctional families and something none of us know anything about. I've got four children, and I always find subjects like this fascinating. A friend of mine's a pastor, and the best time to call him is on Monday morning because that's when he's morose and and full of darkness. I remember, you know, asking him one time, well, what makes a successful family? And he said, a family that stays together. You know, boom, period. I mean, you know, it's hard work being a family, and there's a lot of pressures against us as families and in life. And we're talking tonight about some of the films that that tell stories about dysfunctional families. And we're looking next at The Ice Storm and Little Miss Sunshine. Mm-hmm. Were you going to talk to us about those?
Yes, the next pair that we have that Jenny paired for us are essentially about crisis, families that really are facing times of crisis.
And how many of you have seen Ice Storm or Little Miss Sunshine? How many of you have seen Ice Storm?
Fewer, okay. Yeah. Good. So my job to quickly say, it's made in 1997, directed by Ang Lee, and it was one of the very first American films that he did. And it's he absolutely made his chops on that film. But it's set in the 1970s. It's based on a novel by Rick Moody that's autobiographical. Essentially, if you've seen it, the Tobey Maguire character is Rick Moody. I often say, you told your story, that I grew up in that family, too, in the 70s.
Really? Whereabouts?
In Northern California.
Wow.
And so, those of us who were sort of a certain age, it very much caught that upper middle class, the ice storm as a metaphor for the kind of quiet, silent destruction that is accruing drip by drip in an affluent family where everybody wants to be swinging 70s hipsters, the parents, and the sort of consequences on marriage and the kids, who are sort of mirroring the parents' experimentation with being cool to the point of sudden shattering destruction. It's a very tragic story. Mm-hmm. And Elijah Wood, Tobey Maguire, Christina Ricci, a lot of people who later became film stars or play the kids. It's brilliantly done, and as only Ang Lee can capture human, mm-hmm. that subtle human family relationships. So that paired with Little Miss Sunshine.
Yeah. Well, one of my favorite quotes from that, just talking about family, Tobey Maguire is talking about the Fantastic Four at the beginning of the film, and he says the Fantastic Four were more like a family, right. And the more power they had, the more harm they could do each other without even knowing it.
Right.
Your family is the void you emerge from and the place you return to when you die, and that's the paradox. The closer you're drawn back in, the deeper into the void you go.
Yeah, yeah, amazing.
And that's kind of sums up the movie,
this
void that mm-hmm. this family is falling into.
But then on the other hand, we have the bright, cheerful Little Miss Sunshine.
Yes.
Talk about that one.
Well, lots of you have seen Little Miss Sunshine. It's another movie about a family that is falling apart. But instead of at the end shattering, this family is drawn together, and they find that the way that they can cope with this life and go forward in this life is if they come together, is if they literally get out of the van and push together to make the little yellow VW bus of life roll around on the highway. They need each other. And I still love Little Miss Sunshine. It's still one of my favorites. But if you know the characters, you've got the dad, and he's a self-help guru. He's got 9 steps to success that are not being very successful for himself. So he's unemployed, and his book can't get sold. His wife is a divorcee. His father is snorting heroin and was kicked out of the old folks' home and is now living with them. Her brother just attempted suicide and is now living with them. Their son, the eldest son, just is at one point finds out that he is colorblind and can't fulfill his dream of flying jets for the Air Force. And of course, there's little Olive, who is this sweet little girl who just wants to go to the Little Miss Sunshine beauty pageant. What I love about that too is that at the end of the film, when you're seeing all these beauty pageant, all these fake, mm-hmm. scary-looking children. Frankly, I mean, it's mm-hmm. almost like Chucky. They're scary doll children.
Yeah.
And then out comes Olive. She's just this plain Jane, cute kid, and starts dancing to Super Freak. it's good.
Didn't you love how the difference with Little Miss Sunshine is where the little dripping acts of ice and destruction mm-hmm. in the ice storm are paralleled with these small acts of tender mercy and grace
yes.
mm-hmm. in Little Miss Sunshine, that it's small moments that accrue over the journey of this family that's really unhappy when they begin, and they begin to just forgive each other and mm-hmm. do one small, funny gesture of kindness or love. And it's sort of the, to me, it had this interesting metaphor of being the opposite of accruing the kind of love as the glue holding everyone together in the way that the ice and the water was destructive mm-hmm. in the other one.
I think that's a great point. I mean, when you look at, as Jenny said, the bus being a metaphor for the journey, and they're on the journey together. And it's Steve Carell's character who's kind of seen as the wacko, who's the compassionate one who kind of re-assimilates the emo kid who has that glorious, humorous meltdown as he breaks his vow of silence by dropping the F-bomb at the top of his lungs. But it's the weird uncle who's barely tolerated who becomes the voice of tenderness, of healing and compassion. Right. So while, you know, Alan Arkin's character is very troubling and bothersome as the lascivious old heroin addict, there are these moments of sunshine and Little Miss Sunshine. Yeah. You know, so it's a broken family, but they're trying to make it work, even although they
But how can you have a movie like this and not have sperm?
Well, there was sperm.
It does, really. Yeah, a lot.
Sperm was in the prequel.
Well, you know, but is there a certain cynicism about this film? I mean, I remember when we talked about this film last time, I was like the only person that said, I mean, come on. I mean, I'm really totally into people being fully who they are and God loving us the way we are. But I'm also into God loving us the way we are and loving us too much to leave us the way we are. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And films like this kind of leave us with the sense that all we really need to do is just love each other the way we are. But there's no sense of the need to be transformed. So, I mean, when you read, just the mm-hmm. straightforward description mm-hmm. of this film, in Albuquerque, the housewife Cheryl Hoover brings her suicidal brother Frank to the breast of her dysfunctional and bankrupted family. Frank is homosexual, expert in Proust, and tried to commit suicide when he was rejected by his boyfriend, and his great competitor became renowned and recognized as the number one in the field. Cheryl's husband, Richard, is unsuccessfully trying to sell his self-help and self-improvement technique. He's actually a complete loser. As her son, Dwayne, has taken a vow of silence as a follower of Nietzsche and aims to be a jet pilot. Dwayne's grandfather, sent away from the institution, is addicted to heroin, and then 7-year-old. I mean, there's a certain sense in which, okay, yeah, I want to love these people, but I also believe they need to be transformed. Well, but you know, and so I know I'm a contrarian on this film, and a few others as well.
Well, I would say yes, but then that would be like a Lord of the Rings epic. Like, you've got to find this family where they are now. And
well, you mean so we have to have a
to
sequel
love each other,
where the arc of the story actually has them
transform? Yeah, I mean, because they've got to. They're trying.
Did you see the seeds of transformation in the storyline?
Yes, here they are.
Oh,
telling the truth is what transforms them. Mm-hmm. There's lies in the ice storm, and the people in Little Miss Sunshine stop lying to themselves about who they are, and they're transformed by the truth.
What do you think, Kevin?
Well, you know, it's interesting as you list the different characters in the van, in the family, it almost sounds to me like a litany of ways in the 1980s and 1990s we tried to escape the structure of the family or deal with the dysfunction. We put all these things in a van, these false solutions, and we come back to a place where we realize that none of them are the answer, and that there's something beyond all of these. I mean, I'm with you in terms of I was very nonplussed with the film. I really felt it was the road to nowhere. I mean, they did find each other, but so what? What happens the next day? I didn't feel that they really transcended their situation so much as maybe acknowledged it.
But they rejected what they were chasing after.
Yeah.
Whether it was the contest, the self-help, you know, 9 steps, mm-hmm. all of them ended up saying, wait a minute, that's ridiculous.
Well,
that's
you
not
have to acknowledge
right
it before then you can move on.
Yeah.
I agree, you can't. I mean, so the next day, it'll be rough, but then there, they can.
But there is this cultural value. It's as long as you put all your junk on Oprah's coffee table, you know, that's the virtue, is transparency rather than transformation. So while I would still maintain that there are these glimpses of sunshine, it's business as usual, right? If the movie had another couple of chapters appended to it, would they actually be different people? Would they be others centered? And I think not. So there's a bit of movement where Weird Uncle Frank comes out of his morose Shailen, that reminds us, as we serve others, we find ourselves. So as right. he puts his arm around his troubled nephew, right. then he begins to find himself and live again. But there's only hints, because I think our culture really shies away from transformation. It's like, hey, as long as you put your crap on the table, that's okay. And you've got your crap and I've got my crap and that's okay. But is it possible to experience a power that propels us beyond our crap into a new way of living? I mean, that's the question. Of course, there's an answer to that, and his name is Jesus of Nazareth. But Little Miss Sunshine doesn't even hint at the possibility of some profound, whether it's an Emmaus Road, slow, quiet journey of transformation, or a Damascus Road, hijacking of transformation.
Do you feel like at that point you're asking it to tell a story that it can't tell?
Well, it can't tell that story, right? So maybe I'm just on preaching mode. Of course it can't tell that story. We laughed at it because it was kind of snarky and cynical.
Yeah.
And because Alan Arkin's character just like, and that's a grandfather, you know, so, and Greg Kinnear's lack of self-awareness was painful.
Yeah.
But he gains it at the end. Maybe I grew up in such, you know, I told you, I grew up in the ice storm, so 70s family. But the idea of the crap on the table, the Oprah move, especially because I write a lot about autobiographies in my scholarly work, is that move is the secular form of confession, right? So first thing is the confessing. And what mm-hmm. secular culture does is an endless repeating cycle of confession, because mm-hmm. there is no mm-hmm. interlocutor. You know, where is the one who forgives? Where mm-hmm. is the redeemer? Mm-hmm. And so what we're built in as humans, I think, is to endlessly confess. And that's what we're always right. doing in this truth-telling.
In the cycle.
And so mm-hmm. some of this, what it points to is the idea of, so where, who can forgive? Where is this the sacrificial mm-hmm. redemption? Mm-hmm. And so love of the family or whatever that points toward it is maybe the best that we can get from families, where we see that love and mercy and grace, those, even if they're little moments of sunshine, mm-hmm. are the ways forward from confession. But to notice in our culture that we endlessly confess, and to notice the interlocutors who's missing in mm-hmm. that.
Do you see a redeemer in Little Miss Sunshine?
No. It's the pointing toward what's needed. In a way, it's our very conversation, at least to me, of mm-hmm. they see truth, they see themselves as broken. The father mm-hmm. recognizes his mm-hmm. ridiculousness. All this mm-hmm. even the smarmy grandfather is mm-hmm. the one who gives the young daughter total love. Yeah. For you are perfect just how you are.
Right.
You know, so it's those little, I mean, I don't want to argue for sort of redemptive quality of this mm-hmm. film, but only that we have to ask of some of these stories that they allow to point toward the what's needed, what's missing, what's next, and that mm-hmm. that can be valuable. To me, it's not yeah. just smarmy entertainment, mm-hmm. and that's only what I would want to argue for.
Okay. Yep. Do you have something else?
The only thing I was going to say is, as a screenwriter, I actually see it as a screenwriter crying out for attention to Cyril. Look at, I can create interesting, unique characters. And it was really a showcase for a relatively unknown screenwriter to try and make a name. And boy, did he make a name for himself.
Yeah.
And so I kind of, I'm a little bit cynical about it, because I can hear the conversations, you know, that led to the script. You
it's
know,
a husband and wife team, isn't it?
No.
Jonathan,
Michael Arndt.
Oh, the directors were
but
husband and
you know,
and wife.
I think what you see in a lot of these films is that these people do an amazing job of describing the pathos, the problem, the challenge, the reality.
Right.
And what's lacking is people of similar giftedness and authenticity and grittiness to engage that story with some truth that speaks authentically into that story, and something other than the kind of overly simplistic kind of Band-Aid gospel that a lot of filmmakers who are motivated by their Christian belief, you know, they're not engaging the story at a literary and artistic level that matches the severity of the problem.
Well, you know, one exception I would say, and again, I have no idea where he falls on the spiritual spectrum, is P.T. Anderson. If you look at the movie Magnolia, I mean, he deals very honestly with very, very deep dysfunction, and he shows that the only solution is to acknowledge that there's more going on in life than we see on the surface, and that's how these people find resolution. So I would say it's really an answer to Little Miss Sunshine.
Yeah. You know, I interviewed a lot of National Book Award winners in the fiction category, and what I loved about them was the fact that they were wrestling deeply with spiritual vacuum, with darkness, with emptiness, with hopelessness, with, and they're doing it artistically and creatively and passionately and sincerely, in a sense. You know, and they actually, even Chuck Palahniuk, who wrote Fight Club, you know, when you talk to Chuck Palahniuk off the air, he's on a real journey. He's asking serious questions, you know, and he's not getting serious answers. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason that we have to take these films seriously, because they are articulations of where people really are. I mean, I watched this afternoon, we'll move on to our next set, Away We Go. Mm-hmm. And I, when they visited the couple in Phoenix, and I saw that family in front of their kids, and yeah. I thought, oh my gosh, is it really like this? Mm. And I know it really is like this for some kids. You know, I mean, I just last week had somebody friend me on Facebook, and without getting into the details, he was a kid that was abused, and he was adopted when he was 9, and he was told by the parents that adopted him that they didn't love him. Mm. You know, they were getting the money for taking care of him. And that's the platform for his life. I mean, where do you go from there? And that's real life. That's real story. You know, how do you find gospel in the middle of that? Parenthood and Away We Go. Why'd you put these two together?
Yes. Well, these are two films that are a search for what family can be or what family really is. I mean, is it this, you know, 2.5 kids and a white picket fence and all of that, or can it be something else? Can a family actually function at a place where we come to be healed and loved and sent out into the world? And can it look differently than what we have been programmed or told it has to look like? So these two movies, I think, show that. Parenthood, of course, is the Ron Howard, Steve Martin picture from the 90s, and the TV show that's out right now called Parenthood is based off of this movie. In fact, you have the exact same characters. They just have a new, more, you know, 2010 iteration of who they are. But you've got your patriarch. You've got the sort of, and then basically the sons and the daughters of this patriarch. And one of them's a single mother, of course, with two kids who are, you know, totally, one's into drugs, one's get married at 16 or something of that sort, gets pregnant. He's got another son who's a wayward adult son who's always coming home and asking for money, and he shows up with a kid sometime who's 4 or 5. I can't remember how old the kid is.
Cool.
Oh, yeah, I've got it. Yeah, the kid's name is Cool. You know, it's like, yeah, oh, I have a son I didn't know until about a year ago, you know, that type of thing. And then
that's Kevin's middle name, by the way.
Cool.
I knew it.
C-O-O-L.
Cool Miller.
Yeah. And then you've got the Steve Martin and Mary Steenburgen couple that's sort of the quote-unquote stereotypical middle-class family with the three kids just trying to get everybody to soccer practice and that sort of thing. And then you've got the crazy Rick Moranis character and his wife with the really scary smart kid that she's little and speaks like 5 languages, and he does flashcards, you know, at her all the time. And so you've got these sort of different ways of how you've built a family out, and that's Parenthood. It's a comedy, and it does kind of wrap up in a bow at the end. And then we've got Away We Go, which is a little film that came out in 2009 that I really liked and still enjoy, and I just don't think it got as much press as it should have. And it stars Maya Rudolph and John Krasinski from The Office, and they are a couple in their 30s who are pregnant. They're committed but not married to each other. And they live close to his parents, who have decided to move to Belgium. And so with their 6 months pregnant and thinking, well, I guess the grandparents aren't going to be around, so what are we going to do? And they go off visiting friends and family around North America, trying to find a place for themselves, for them to have family. And it's their search for that. And as Dick said, this family in Arizona with Allison Janney is the mom, and I just love Allison Janney. She was in The Ice Storm, too, mm-hmm. which is kind of mm-hmm. odd. But
the
anyhow,
key party scene.
Yeah, and the key party scene.
What do you love about her?
I love how she's
the lunatic.
Well, no, as an actress.
As an actress.
She's just a chameleon. She will do anything to, I just.
Right, right.
But in this, she is sort of this horrible, loud, badmouth her kids within their hearing. mother, then they go on to Friends, played by Maggie Gyllenhaal, who's the stereotypical, very, very left, hippy-dippy, still breastfeeding at 4 years old, you know, mom, that they all sleep in the big family bed and doesn't want a stroller because she loves her children. Why would I want to push them away from me, she says. So that's, you know, that, they go to that, and then they go head up to Montreal, and they see this family that it's all adopted kids. And
see, they have to go to Canada.
They have to go to Canada.
That's right.
To
find family is in Canada.
French Canada, though.
Yeah, Canada.
That's problematic right there.
And it's kind of this really idyllic, I mean, you come upon this idyllic family, but then you realize that there's a lot of pain there as well. And I thought what was interesting in this scene is they come in and all these kids are different races and different ages, and they're all watching The Sound of Music. And they say, and I think it's so long, farewell, and then the movie's over, and they acted out. It's adorable. You're like, this is what I want my family to, you know, I want my four children to sing this song. And then the movie's over, and I forget which character says it, but says, oh, so you don't show the Nazis? The Von Trapps don't ever meet the Nazis? And they're kind of like, yeah, why? Why really? You know, basically make the kids sad. And watch that. So they don't show the Nazis in there. Anyhow, finally they wind up going back to, Maya Rudolph is orphaned, her children, her parents are dead, and they wind up coming back to her, the place that she grew up, and finding their own version of what family is.
So it's a couple trying to find a model, trying to find a vision of what a family would be and not finding it. Mm-hmm. So then they got to make up their own.
They do. Yeah. But what's wonderful about them as a couple is there is a sense, even though they're not married, there is a sense of a deep abiding commitment and love that they are going to make this work however they can.
Yeah. What do the rest of you see in these films about family and dysfunction?
I you know, I'm just sitting here thinking about three stages, almost like over maybe a few decades here, that people first acknowledging that whatever this system is, it's not working. And so then the next stage is, you know what, we don't need family. We'll just sort of make it on our own. And I see that, you know, when I listen to the descriptions of some of these films, it's like, no, we do need family, but it can't look like the old family. So we got to figure out the new family. And I still think we're figuring out the new family. I mean, we're working that on TV right now, the modern family.
Yep, you know, the modern family.
I think that's... Yeah. So it's saying that basically we can't get rid of this structure. We just need to
But this goes
the shape
back to David Lynch in Blue Velvet, where you start the movie and the guy's mowing the lawn, and then underneath the lawn you see all the bugs.
Right. Yeah.
And it's like underneath the veneer of the 50s family was all this stuff that's being honestly surfaced now.
Well, that's
It's like we don't want to go back to the superficiality, mm-hmm.
right?
But we haven't found the new model,
the solution. Yeah,
and that's Sam Mendes, isn't it? He loves to pull the rocks up and say, mm-hmm. "Let's all take a look at the bugs together."
Yeah, mm-hmm.
American Beauty.
Yep. Yeah,
and then really, while there is a winsomeness and poignancy about Away We Go, it's really a deconstruction of marriage as a lifelong covenanted relationship. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you know.
Yeah, go ahead. I was just going to say, right, it's sort of the DIY, you know, aesthetic of the current contemporary generation with the beards and everything. Mm-hmm. The whole idea that you sort of do it yourself, you make your own vows.
This just happens.
I have some of my students over there, and they have beards, so that was for them. But it's the two...
Men are women.
Yeah, both, yeah. the parent... Wouldn't you say that the film Parenthood was how to be a perfect parent?
Yes.
And Away We Go was how to be a cool parent. Mm-hmm. And what struck me is the interesting difference that the jobs that the professional couple at the center of both of those films, one, they're totally mobile and digital. Away We Go. You can travel all over the country, still both be working professionals, but you're utterly making your own everything. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Steve Martin Parenthood, being the perfect sort of 80s, 90s, was, you know, making partner at the firm that he worked at. And it's total suburbia, total huge McMansion. And to me, what's interesting is the way that being cool is the new definition of being sort of respective, responsive. Mm-hmm. Their sexuality is so egalitarian, it's almost, you know, unbelievable. It's way too good in a way. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's the way that this sort of shaping of, we will control it. We'll make our own vows on the trampoline instead of having a wedding. You know, we'll go back to the family home, but hope it'll be good. It's like the Victorian era where Matthew Arnold's poems say, you know, all love, let us be true to one another, because that's kind of all we have in the life without certainty.
I don't think a way we go is a quest for co-parenting. There's a loss of the perfect parents, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right, so she's kind of missing what her healthy parents could bring in terms of mentoring and support and nurturing mm-hmm. as they raise a child. Then he wants commitment, which she is unable to give. It's not unwilling, but somehow emotionally mm-hmm. unable to give. And then there's maybe the symbolism of the narrative where they live in a shack.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
They live in a shack,
yeah.
And you think they're also looking for a place. They're in the gorgeous, wide-open spaces, and there's some lush, wide shots, but then really they end up in a big shack. So it's yeah. a little shack with a cardboard window to a derelict big house. So she's kind of going back to her roots,
right.
back to somehow try and recapture something that she can't.
Well, and what's interesting, too, is that part of her lack of wanting to have that commitment is from the pain of her parents' death. Mm, so it's
right.
not
yeah.
this sort of, you know, postmodern sort of, I don't want my love to be on paper. Like, it's not that sort of attitude.
Yeah.
It's more that she's, you know,
because of that
death
loss.
Has rocked her
yeah.
entire life.
Every one of these movies, if we're talking about dysfunctional families, starts with a marriage
yeah.
that's dysfunctional. Starts with a marriage that these kids are not wanting. And that's kind of, back to what everybody's been saying, the questions that's being explored is, well, what would a functional marriage look like? What would a family look like? What? Why does this couple not want to be married? Why do they think that's unnecessary? Well, because they haven't seen one that makes sense.
Well, maybe the solution or the quest is to say, how do we minimize the damage of family? Because that seems to be a lot
wow.
of what's happening.
Wow. And that's kind of a sobering thought. Well, we're going to get back now and find out what the audience here, the live audience, is thinking. Write down your questions and comments. We'll get back to our live audience with their comments and questions, including things like, what are some of your favorite dysfunctional movies? Are there any movies that you know of that have positive outcomes from dysfunctional families? And more. Stay with us. This is Dick Stahl. We'll be right back. Gentlemen, boys and girls, this is Dick Stahl. Thanks for joining us tonight in the Kindling's Muse. We're talking about family dysfunction, a subject that comes naturally to all of us on the panel.
Yes.
And we've had an interesting conversation about what's going on in Hollywood and its treatment of dysfunctional families. And now we get into the exciting part of the show where we go out into the highways and byways and talk to mere mortals who bring the panel to their knees with their wisdom and wit. And we start with Manny. Is that a big enough build-up for you, Manny?
Certainly.
Okay, buddy. Go for it.
All right. So I wanted to talk maybe about the relationships that we see that might be the foundations for the next generation of family. So my thought was, could you guys talk a little bit about Garden State and Eternal Sunshine as maybe, you know, do you see those as positive examples or are those sort of, again, the cynical? Just maybe talk about that in terms of, you know, the young adults maybe, you know, starting the next generation of family.
Okay.
Jenny.
Well, I'm going to ask them, but then I want to ask, bounce that back on you.
Sure.
Like, what did you see in Garden State? Okay, anybody up here?
When I think about Eternal Sunshine, of course, he's wanting to erase everything.